Safety Subcommittee of the whole committee to order so that we can go ahead and begin. We don't have a quorum of the full committee, but we can hear things in a subcommittee of the whole. So we're going to go ahead and proceed. I know Representative Butler was going to be late today, so he sent his apologies, but he had some things flare up in his district he had to deal with. We have two items on the agenda. We don't intend to do a work session today, and so we'll lead with Monica. I do have an intern here today, Kara, and she's a second year at the U of O, so she's expecting great things out of you lawyers to see. You know, when we all grow up to be big lawyers, what we can do. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I got a chance to get it.
She lives in your district, by the way, I think.
I think everybody lives in my district, actually. In the back here is the physician of the day, Dr. Kathleen Weaver, who I had the opportunity
Welcome,
to
Dr. Weaver.
Recognize on the Senate floor. So. She's here in the building if you have any questions. And she's a
doctor. Did you bring her for Senator George, who's been very ill?
So.
All right. Well, thank you for coming, Doctor, as well. Monica, you want to go ahead and introduce the Commissioner on Judicial Fitness and Disability?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, yesterday I delivered a packet to your office, and there's a packet at your place if you need another copy. Judicial Fitness and Disability Commission essentially has one purpose, and that is to review complaints on the conduct of judges in the state of Oregon. It's a nine-member commission, and I'll let the director discuss in more detail. It's a relatively small budget. It's under $210,000. It is 100% general fund. And the agency is staffed by two part-time positions and co-located with the current executive director's private law office. I have one correction to the packet that I distributed. The cost for investigating cases, which is one of the primary drivers in this budget, I had noted that one case could exceed $200,000. It's actually $100,000. A difficult case could cost that much, and if that's the case, could cause some difficulty with this agency's budget if they were to encounter that. The Legislative Fiscal Office's analysis of the governor's budget is attached. And a representative from Budget and Management could discuss the governor's position on that more thoroughly later. Also in the packet is a description of the special session actions that were taken to this agency. It's about a 6.5% reduction that the agency took this biennium. They have been able to absorb those adjustments with minimal impact, but was not completely easy for them, but they were able to do it. So with that, Mr. Chair, I guess the other items are there were no budget notes, no audit reports from the interim to report on for this agency.
Okay. And typically, I believe this agency has been, the anticipation was is that if they had a big, expensive case to investigate, that they would come to the emergency board.
That's correct.
Is my understanding. We want to hear from BAM first. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dick Feeney. I am a member of the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, and with me is Susan Isaacs, who is our executive director. She's been a lawyer, member of the bar in the state of Oregon, practicing for 25 years. We're very lucky and proud to have her with us. Also with me is the current chairman of the commission, Judge David Brewer, who's right here to my left, and we would just
see. You can pull up the chair, David, if you want to.
I picked a short straw, Mr. Chairman, because I did this last year.
You do such a good job.
We are happy to report that we have been living within the budget that the legislature gave us, including the reductions. We do. We would like to remind and you and hope that you would support our concern that if there are significant cases that come before us that need a great deal of attention and professional assistance, that the cost for those are more. We are very happy to go to the e-board to ask for. The funds to do that, and that's what we agreed to do last year. We were able to meet our costs last year with the budget that was given us. We have the responsibility of reviewing complaints. There are inquiries for complaints of about 350 in a year's time. Of that, about, I think as Susan has noted, about 120 of them have actually come back as real complaints. And the commission, with the assistance of our executive director, have reviewed every one of them. Occasionally, the review takes a dialogue with the judge, maybe the subject of a complaint. But in every case, it is reviewed, and sometimes it has to be pursued, and it can lead to sanctions that are authorized under law. We have not had many of those. We've had some, and they averaged two or three a year, and this last 2 years were not terribly expensive. In the past, some of those have been lengthy, very public, and they do have some expense with them. We have not had to incur any expense over our budget. Susan is here to go over every piece of the budget if you'd like, answer any questions you might have with the commission or me or Judge Brewer, we'd be happy to respond.
Thank you. Judge Brewer, did you have anything to add?
No, other than to thank you so much for your time and interest in this important endeavor, and to just let you know how much we appreciate the legislature's support. The public trust in the judiciary of the state is a critical part of our entitlement to judicial independence, and this commission's function is I think, critical to that. And we very much appreciate your support for our work. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. As Mr. Feeney said, the job is to monitor the ethical conduct of judges, and when an ethics rule has been violated, to institute a prosecution. The commission has no independent authority to discipline. However, that rests with the Supreme Court. We are performing well. We're very pleased to have remained within our budget. We have absorbed the cost since the Gallagher and Fadley matters in the 95-97 biennium. We have absorbed many costs since I took over in November of 2000. We have had three completed prosecutions, and we currently have two pending, and we've been able to absorb them within our budget. We don't know what's going to happen with the two we have pending, and if need be, we would come to the e-board. We will continue to expect to fulfill our mission with our goals of excellent customer service, which means answering inquiries from the public and reviewing their complaints. And moving forward, we also continue to protect the public from the unethical conduct of judges, and the outcome would be, of course, to fulfill our mission statement, which is to ensure the quality and effectiveness of the state judicial system. We do monitor not only the circuit court and appellate judges, but also justices of the peace and municipal court judges. So we have more than just what you think of as going to court. I did want to say that in my budget narrative, I wanted to correct an error. We sent out 353 packets of forms during 2002, not 268. And then, as indicated in 2001, we had 362. So we get a high volume of inquiries. We do talk to a lot of people on the phone and assist them in what they need. If you have any other questions, I am hopefully prepared to answer them.
Questions from the committee? Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you've stated, there have been few cases as high profile as the ones that you mentioned. As you've stated, you know, it's very important to maintain the public's high opinion of the court. I only wish that their opinion of the legislature was half as high.
As lawyer legislators, it's very, very tough.
We have a very high opinion.
The commission has a very high opinion.
But, you know, you receive a large number of complaints. Some of them are probably legitimate. Some of them are not. But have you seen in the past where when you receive complaints that are legitimate, that you get a pattern of complaints about a particular judge, and what kind of action do you take if you start to get a pattern of complaints? And has that been the circumstance that you've seen when you end up with a major case?
We do see that occasionally. We will sometimes look back and see historically, my goodness, this individual has had an awful lot of demeanor complaints. That seems to be what it is. And in the past, we had a situation where there's not an actual violation of the code. And I can think of one judge in particular that the commission directed me to simply advise that individual. We've had a number of complaints about your demeanor, and we have not had a complaint about that individual since then. So we have that sort of interim situation where the individual does not exactly violate the code. And also the commission, since I took over in November 2000, has had a directive to me to speak as much as possible before judges and convey the message that we do get an awful lot of demeanor complaints. Not an awful lot, but, you know, we get some, and it's not an ethical violation. And so we hope that has been effective as well, to remind people that sometimes this is the only time someone goes to court, and they need to know that they're being heard and that the individual's patient with them.
Excuse me, if I may, I'm just in response to the Senator's question. You may also be looking at the issue of progressive discipline. In other words, what do you do with somebody that you have to discipline more than once? And that issue hasn't arisen often since I've been on the commission. We have had probably two cases like that, and I know that the commission's practice, its policy, is that there is progressive sanction and discipline as appropriate for repeat offenses. And so you don't get free passes, and the second offense of the same nature as the first is not going to be treated as leniently as a practical matter. So if that's part of your question, I think that would fit. Would you agree with that?
I'd agree. There also might be a pattern over time would reveal that there's a disability that needs to be dealt with, and referrals made.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions from the committee? I just got a question. Have you made it? Does the commission ever make recommendations to the court as to the ethics rules? And when was the last time the commission ever looked at the ethical rules for judges to find out if they really were workable based upon the caseload that you get, the number of complaints that you get, and in dealing with really the credibility of the judiciary? I just wondered, when's the last time you looked at evaluating your rules?
You know, there was a complete overhaul of the code effective January 1997, and then we went from the canons to a code of judicial conduct. And as most of the time changes to the judicial code go before all the judges in the judicial conference, and of course we have judges on the commission, and I keep them, everybody informed about that. I know that we have reviewed matters, but we have not commented on them, is my recollection. Some changes last year, but we ended up not commenting.
We were asked to comment on changes that were promulgated by the Judicial Conduct Committee of the Judicial Conference in the last 2 years. We have felt that it would be appropriate for us to discuss procedural issues and to give feedback to the Supreme Court, which is responsible for the code, on areas of procedure and practice. Policy judgment, we've been a little more reluctant, Representative Patridge, to do that, only because the commission, while its members have individual views, I think needs to be perceived as a neutral agency in a situation like this. And in passing on substantive policy judgments, we've been a little more reluctant to speak as a commission. And I think that's worked well with the Supreme Court. That's what they've expected from us. They have asked us, would such and such a change work for the way you do your work? And we've always felt very comfortable commenting on that.
But I guess my question goes more towards, you kind of have the responsibility of making recommendations that generally, for lack of a better term, protect the public or deal with the complaints, though the Supreme Court is not bound by, obviously, by your recommendations. You are the recommending body to the Supreme Court. And I guess as I look at your commission, that raises the question in my mind as to, you know, do you feel like the complaints that you have adequately are dealt with within the realm of the judicial code as it currently stands? And that's just I don't have an axe to grind in this area.
Yes.
I'm just trying to ask, because it is a very
all three of us.
Probably I'm the only one on this committee who probably ever reads much, and other than maybe a constituent calling you and saying, "Oh, you can't believe this judge."
All
beyond
three of us
that,
would say yes, I think, to that. And okay. I think that Ms. Isaacs pointed out the most significant type of complaint that we get by volume relates to demeanor on the bench and the way judges treat people. And judges who are imperious and are rude and discourteous to the public justifiably get complaints against them. I would say that's at least half of the bulk of the complaints that we get. Very little in the way of dishonesty. Very little in the way of overt allegations of corruption. Generally, it's judges not treating people well enough. And so our education program, which has been really carried out under Dick and Susan's guidance and leadership, has directed itself to that. We've all spoken at conferences around the state about that issue, although we're not permitted because of confidentiality to discuss the facts of particular cases with other judges. We can discuss the patterns. And so we're working very hard on those key problem areas. But to answer your question specifically, I think the existing rules capture the type of misconduct we deal with adequately.
We've not, to my knowledge, have ever come up with anything that we felt was outside, oh my goodness, we should be able to deal with this, and it wasn't covered.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the application, the request for investigation, and I notice over here on the third page, it says relationship with the case, and it says attorney for. But my question was, what happens when an attorney feels a demeanor or an ethical or something? What's the procedure there? It just shows you my ignorance of the process.
The attorney can use the same procedure.
Can use the same procedure.
And they do.
We have judges make complaints. Yeah. We have members of the public make complaints. And we have lawyers make complaints.
Now, is there any...
Go ahead, please.
Is there any procedure, for example, I'm sure it would be some violation, I would consider of ethics, if in fact there was some retaliation for the fact that, this, you know, would this be disclosed that this individual had, this particularly this attorney had filed a complaint?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
Generally, we have statutory confidentiality, and most complaints do not come to the attention of the judge. In fact, even if the judge inquired and said, "Do you have any complaints about me?" we would have to say, "I can't respond to that." Only comes to the attention where we need to go to the judge and say, you know, we've had this allegation, we have some questions about what happened. Mm-hmm. Then that can be part of our investigation, as well as contacting the attorney for each side, anybody else that was present, getting a copy of the record. We have different avenues for investigation. I do not recall any allegations of retaliation since I took over in November 2000. I don't recall anything like that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Senator, let me...
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
First, what I want to do
is open up the... I'm going to close the subcommittee and open up the full committee so that we at least have the full committee on record.
Thank you. These
are judges. They understand process.
Yes.
We got that, Kristen.
Okay. And Representative Butler is excused. So we do want to go over performance measures, and do you want to speak to that first, or do you want... I know that they have, I think, three or four performance measures.
I think they have Rule 5, Mr. Chair.
Five.
I just wanted to bring it up in no way that you wanted to address it at this time. I'll wait for work session. But I believe Ms. Isaacs is prepared to discuss the performance measures.
While we have them here, we might as well do it, because when we work these, we're going to go through them quickly, I think. So, go ahead.
I alluded to them earlier. Basically, we try to fulfill these requests for forms right away, same day or the next day. We also try to be very responsive to telephone calls to speak to people when they call that day or the next day. And, of course, having the commission housed in the law office gives the advantage that when the phone rings, generally there's somebody there, unless, like, for example, my secretary was sick last week and I was in court, but that's very rare. Usually the phones are covered. Again, presentations per year, which I to have spoken. I usually speak to the new judges seminar. I've been also honored to be asked to speak before the judicial conference of state and the circuit court and appellate judges. I've gone to municipal court judges seminars. So, but we have a target of 2, although it can be more. We want to make an effort to have the initial complaint and the end of the case, at least our part of the oral argument. We like to have a 2-year timeline, and that's probably just laudatory, not necessarily that possible with regard to the amount of time it takes to process these things, but it is a goal because of the protection of the public aspect. And then finally, we do review all complaints between each meeting. I mean, nothing comes in. I mean, of course, we have to send out the agenda, so it's, if something comes in the day before, it doesn't get to the meeting. But we are always on target on that, and we're very fortunate. So everything new goes to the commission. The next meeting is resolved. So in that way, we also protect the public and keep things moving. So in that way, we don't have a primary link to the benchmarks, but this does go right to our mission. So that's about all I have on that.
I've got one other question. Can you just explain to the committee what you do to make the public knowledgeable about your commission? Wasn't mentioned here or in your performance measures, and a lot of people probably who might make a complaint probably wouldn't know. So can we talk a little bit about that?
We're on the web. We have a website now, which is very exciting. It was something that was we had it in process for quite a while, but then the Judicial Department, Norcross in particular, took it over what we had going and put it together for us. And as a matter of fact, I just put in Judicial Fitness Commission into my computer before I came down and pulled it right up, and it's great. So people can download all these complaint information, and I'm going to see if we have a decrease in the number of calls, sort of monitor whether having it on the web increases the number of people that contact us, decreases the number of requests, I don't know, but the information is on the web, our complaint form, the code, all that stuff. People cannot electronically send in their complaint, though. I don't think we've really had that much trouble with people finding us. You know, we get referrals from everywhere. We get referrals from state senators, state legislators, federal. You know, we're in all phone books all across the state because, you know, we go in each phone book. I pay the bills, so write to request that I have the bills paid. And the bar refers people to us. I mean, we get... And the number of complaint packets we send out isn't necessarily... I mean, most people ask for it or we offer it because it gives a really good overview. But that doesn't even mean that we send them out to everybody that asks. I mean, we get a lot of calls.
Yeah, also had that. I was a trial judge before coming to the Court of Appeals in Lane County for 6 years. And we had, as most of the circuit courts do around the state, a procedure where if a litigant or a member of the public called into the court to complain about a judge's conduct, that person had to be referred to the Judicial Fitness Commission. So there are many key nodal points, if you will, where these referrals get made. And you're right to be concerned about some possible slippage, but we've thought about that. And I'm really, you know, would be wide open to thoughts about how we can improve that. But I think there's a pretty wide net for someone, as Susan said, who's motivated.
I just think it's incumbent for us to put that on the record so the public can get hold of you. I feel like that's an important
thing. And we also make referrals to other people. A lot of times people call us. They're asking for the Department of Justice. They want the bar. They think that we also do disability services for the general public, not just judges. So we get a lot of calls. We act as a resource. We try to give them the number.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee? Mr. Padilla? Then?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Members of the committee, I'm Satish Padilla with the Department of Administrative Services, sitting in for Adam Ferguson, who's the finance, who's in the next room. He's having a hearing at the same time. This day, the commission is not under executive budgetary control, so we do not have any recommendations.
Any questions for staff? or BAM, I guess.
No, I just want to thank you for your time.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Chairman, thank you for volunteering.
Thanks for
doing
it.
I would open it up to anyone from the public who would like to speak to the Judicial Fitness Commission. We have some people signed up, but I think those people are for the court procedure, the Council on Court Procedures. So, seeing nobody leap from their seat to discuss anything on the Judicial Fitness Commission, I will then close the public hearing on the Judicial Fitness Commission, and we will be contacting you when we decide to put this into work session.
Thank you.
Okay. Now the Senate is abandoning us. I don't know what that says for the Council on Court Procedure, but I'm going to open a subcommittee of the subcommittee of the subcommittee, I guess, in this case. On item number 2 of our agenda, Council on Court Procedures. Monica, do you want to give us maybe, I don't know how long they've both stepped out into the hall. I was hoping they'd dash back in here. I think we can probably just go ahead with the House members, since they are the most important. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Council on Court Procedures is a 23-member council, has two primary responsibilities. One is to review and amend the rules of civil procedure, and the second, to act as an advisory and provide technical analysis to legislative committees on the rules as they see fit. Again, relatively small budget, probably one of the smaller ones you'll see in the subcommittee, but it's $111,396 in the governor's balanced budget. All of that, except for $8,000, is general fund. The $8,000 is revenue received from the state bar to cover the travel costs of the council to meetings. There are two part-time positions with this council as well, and as such, personal services dollars are the primary driver of this agency's budget. They are co-located at the University of Oregon Law School, so there's some economies of scale for services and supplies and facility usage. They did have some small across-the-board reductions taken during a couple of sessions activity during the interim, and they have been able to absorb those with minimal effects on services. A copy of Legislative Fiscal Office's analysis of the governor's balanced budget is attached. Governor's balanced budget is roughly a 16% increase, largely attributable to benefit adjustments and state government service charge adjustments. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Monica. Any questions for Monica? Seeing none, would the commission like to proceed? Who's going first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ralph Spooner. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, Oregon. My office is located at 530 Center Street, Suite 722. The law firm is Spooner, Much, and Amon, PC. I've been practicing here in Oregon for 30 years. I've been on the council. This is my first term. The members generally are appointed to four-year terms. I'm the current chair of the council. You have the information regarding the organization of the council. We have a judge from the Oregon Supreme Court, a judge from the Court of Appeals. We have 8 circuit judges, 1 public member, and then the balance of the 23-member council are lawyers that are appointed. With regard to our staffing, as you're aware, there are part-time positions for budgetary purposes, but I can tell you our council would not function without the services of our executive director, Maury Holland, and our executive assistant, Gilma Henthorne. They give way above the remuneration they receive in terms of organizing the council matters in putting out the agendas, in putting out all of the correspondence. We are updated and have a listserv on the email, which they maintain. They've done everything they can to minimize the cost involved in doing our work. We're well aware of the budget constraints here in the state of Oregon. I can also tell you that if you looked at the membership of the council, you have highly talented individuals giving their time to this work. And if you want to know their dedication, I know I made the presentation last year and somebody had a question about what we really did. The first thing I'd point out is that given the schedules of everybody, we meet on Saturdays, usually once a month. And for most of us, there are things that we would obviously rather be doing. The second thing that I want to note, and I think you're aware of, all the work's pro bono. And if you said, well, how much work is really involved in this thing? Is this just a little deal where you get together and meet? There are hundreds and hundreds of hours put in by our committee members. We work pretty similar to what the legislature does. We have our formal meetings with hearings and votes, but we also have appoint subcommittees who work on things that maybe to the public would appear to be somewhat esoteric and not important, but in the real world they make a huge difference. This year I think we amended 8 or 9 rules. I testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee the other day. And the work, if this isn't funded, the work won't be done. I mean, the net effect would be our Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure would simply remain in their present form, or alternatively, the legislature would have to take up this work. And as I indicated, in my estimation, just doing some rough calculations the other day, I can confidently say that during the biennium, there's several $100,000 of free, if you will, volunteer labor that you're receiving from these judges and lawyers. The type of work that we do, as I said, has some real substance to it. There's some real meat and potatoes there. We had, for example, and it's something that's been worked on for 3 sessions now, changes in the federal law regarding disclosure of medical records, and to try to bring Oregon rules in conformance with the federal law, and to avoid the natural controversy that takes place when you put plaintiff's lawyers against defense lawyers. What we've done, and I served on that subcommittee last session, but what we've done is we've gotten the cooperation of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. I happen to do primarily defense work. I'm a past chair of that. And we got the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to get together to appoint volunteer members, which we then appointed to our subcommittee, not as members of the council, but to work together in a joint fashion so that we could get a work product that avoided all the natural fighting that would occur when you start dealing with issues like this. We also got the OMA to participate. Their counsel, Tom Cooney, has participated in that subcommittee, and we also got the Hospital Association to participate. The net effect for Oregonians is that we were able to change our law, conform to the federal law, assuming these changes are adopted, and save the public and the court system a lot of money and time. We also, and I won't go through all the rules today, that's not the purpose of this hearing, but we've had a number of these rules where we've looked at the court system, how it works, and I'll just give you one more example. We have moved to conform our rules of civil procedure with the federal so that requests for production are continuing requests, and that may not seem like a big thing to a layperson, but if you have a piece of litigation that's ongoing for 1 to 2 years, parties were submitting multiple requests for production, which required doctors' offices, hospitals, then to double back and redo the same work. where there were fights going on over the law of privilege, whether someone did or did not have to disclose information. We were taking up time in court with court hearings on whether these things were allowed or not under our rules. And in fact, I just tried a case in Lane County for 2 weeks, professional liability case against two lawyers, where one of the issues was their failure to do continuing requests. And of course, when they tried to do it, the other side objected. It's just a small illustration of something that can take up a lot of time and money, and it's something where I think the committee, being composed of both lawyers, judges, and appellate judges, recognize the practical way to deal with these rules. So those are my comments today. I have Maury Holland here with us, the executive director. He certainly has the history. He's been involved with the council since it was originally created. And both of us are here to answer any questions you might have.
Professor Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I really don't have, I have very little to add to what Mr. Spooner has said. Just 2 points. That the council was created, of course, by the legislature back in 1977 in response to a recommendation of a commission that was appointed by the governor in the 19, Governor McCall. And one of the inadequacies in the Oregon judicial system that that commission identified was that the rules of procedure, which were then statutory, had fallen behind the times and were sort of obsolete and not working as well as they should. For example, Oregon was one of the last jurisdictions in the United States to merge law and equity. And that didn't happen until the council produced the first set of rules. In any event, as Mr. Spooner was saying, someone somewhere and somehow is going to have to do this job, and the council permits it to be done by people, and it's only a tiny number of people in this state, probably fewer than 1% of Oregonians know or care anything about the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, except maybe if they become a litigant. And that's true, with all due respect, I think, of the vast majority of legislators and their constituents. I've never heard of anybody being elected to the legislature on a platform of liberalizing the joinder rules or something of that kind. And with all of the enormously difficult high visibility work that you people have to do in a relatively short period of time, it's understandable that prior to the council, the rules usually got a short shrift. And the advantage of the council is that we have the membership are people who work with these rules virtually every day and know more about them and care more about them than anybody else could possibly do. And I think that's worked out very well. The rules we now have are well thought of for the most part. So I think it's a good way to run this particular railroad and to keep it out of your hair, so to speak, during the session, except on those rare occasions when, as they're entitled to do, someone comes in and asks you to override something the council has done. You've, of course, properly retained that authority. But it hasn't happened very often, and I don't think in recent years it has happened at all. And again, Mr. Spooner mentioned there is a committee that is available to the legislature if and when someone comes in and says, now, wait a minute, the council has done this and the other thing. You've got to change it. You've got to correct it. You've got to disallow it. The council could be consulted very rapidly. Obviously, the decision would finally be with you people in the legislature. The other and the only other thing I'll say, the second point, is that Oregon courts nationally, state courts, have a pretty good reputation for being relatively expeditious and relatively inexpensive in the way they conduct litigation. This is a relative matter. But compared to other states, this seems to be the case, and they take pride in that. And the council very often tries to contribute to that by seizing on any opportunity that comes the council's way to further expedite and further cheapen or make less expensive the civil litigation process. One example that you will see in your capacity as members of the House or Senate that you will vote on at some point is the substitution of declarations for affidavits. Again, a very technical point, but I think it can save hundreds of hours of lawyers' time using declarations. This was done by the council in collaboration with the bar, in particular the Practice and Procedure Committee, because it required statutory changes too. And naturally I'm biased. I love the council. I've been with it for a long time, and I hope it can continue to function. It's a great group of people. It does seem to be true in Oregon that the volunteer tradition is very strong and alive here, and I don't think the state would survive if it weren't true. So much work is done by volunteers. I do volunteer work in other capacities. I guess all of us do in one way or another. Let me just finally add this, that I've been compensated, as has the executive assistant, who's much more dependent on this income than I am, and been glad to be compensated. But as I've told people in the council, I would be willing to do this work for nothing if that were the situation, to donate my time. So if in your wisdom and under the pressures that you're facing, should you conclude that the budget needs to be reduced, and I think it's just a question probably of how much, the way that the council could absorb a reduction would be a reduction in my compensation or even the elimination, depending upon the amount of that you have to do. That's not something I'm urging, but I'm saying that if it comes to that, Oregon's been very good to me since I came here 16 years ago. I have a nice position at the university, and I love that. And so I'd be more than happy, if the circumstances dictate, to become in part or in whole pro bono, a volunteer. Thank you.
Carl, thank you for your selflessness in terms of being before the committee. We certainly appreciate it. We do face very difficult economic times in the state, so we appreciate that.
Thank
Representative
you,
Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to echo exactly what you said, Professor Hong. You know, that is very kind, and I sincerely appreciate it. The legislature took about a 9% cut in our pay, and recently the new incoming governor did too, with a lot of fanfare and those kinds of things. But you know, that spirit of community selflessness and the kindness which you and the obvious feeling which you have for the council and court procedures is very evident. And I appreciate that. I feel humbled and honored to be with somebody that feels that way about their profession so strongly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Representative Hanley.
One question, Mr. Chair, and after that incredibly generous offer that I would hope that we don't have to take up, but there is a more of a technical question, Mr. Chair. As we adjust our budgets, work our way through these budgets, and we have to make the adjustment from the governor's budget to the 10% revenue growth figure.
Right.
Will that apply to even the small budgets, or should we? Is it possible to get like? Well, I'm thinking, for example, if we were staying consistent across the board, would that mean a $3,000 cut to this budget or a $12,000?
Just to set the table so the audience understands what we're talking about, too. The governor assumed a 14% rate of growth in his budget for the next biennium. we have been tasked by the co-chairs in Ways and Means to assume a 10% rate of growth as opposed to a 14% rate. So consequently, then we're looking for, within our budget silo of the public safety budgets, for a 4% reduction. It is not my intent to do those in an across-the-board fashion. I don't think that that's appropriate, and I think that there are budgets who have suffered continual declines over many years, and others who haven't. So I think we will continue to look at those. These budgets were not something that, you know, they are obviously, every budget is on the table, but until we do work sessions and obviously get the May revenue forecast.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I was asking that question is, and this could be like a thread throughout the hearings that we have, would be if we could get a response, which we've already had here, in terms of what further reductions could be and what the impact would be. But if we could get that type of a response from each budget, if there's a potential that there's going to be an additional reduction, getting their feel in terms of either what they might, what services they might not be able to perform, or where they would recommend that cut would come out of their budget, could be very helpful to us.
From the big budgets, we have requested that.
Mr. Chair, I think that we ought to turn to Monica about a portion of this budget, because a portion of this budget is the increase is nearly 16%. Is increased because of the PERS anticipated increase, and this may be an area where we have very little control over the overall increases. But and Mr. Chair, you and I, and sitting in with the co-chairs, have just a little bit different read, because in addition to the 4% from where the governor is at, that 14 to 18% increase, there's also a 3% that they want held back for the ending balance. So I'm adding that 3% onto the efficiencies that have been directed of our budgets in general government, and we do need to get some further information on that. But we also have a 1.5%, if House Bill 2001 passes through, we also have a 1.5% cut in that PERS rate. So I recognize that isn't a lot, but that is probably the major item, the PERS flex benefits, that causes the 16% increase in this budget.
And I think we're having the subcommittee chairs meeting tomorrow morning, so I think Representative Butler and I, based upon the comments that this committee's made and Representative Butler's committee's made, we'll press for answers as to some clarity as to where we're headed.
Monica, do you have any feel at this point how the PERS budget, if we do in effect have a 1.5% off of the top rate, which would be the equivalent of about a 4% reduction, for maybe 5% reduction in PERS for these agencies, do you have any feel for that? It's probably the biggest single increase in this budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we're still working through some of those issues. Honestly, another thing that will come into effect is the no merit, no COLA calculation that we will be doing statewide. The numbers that you have before you in these, especially these early budgets before we go into work session, we have not withdrawn any of those incremental adjustments that we know are coming, one pending further instruction on which ones to include and which ones not to include when we get to our budget. But of the two agencies that you heard today, you're correct. Personal services account for significant portions of these, and obviously PERS is a major contributor to that. So you will be seeing some adjustments to those accounts as we move through. The other large adjustments in both of the agencies that you heard today are the state government service charges. And as you well know, a lot of those assessment agencies are having their public hearings now, and we could be seeing adjustments come out of those.
You're hearing one, and we're hearing one next week.
So. Mr. Chair, in that regard, and you sit on that general government where that agency charge will be flowing through, maybe I know 4 years ago what we did with that small agency, particularly the commissions and other small agencies, was that we took a look at those very small budgets and asked for a revision in the DAS service charge.
And that would be something we might want to take a look at requesting of the new administrator of the Department of Administrative Services, and that is these small budgets not be nailed with the same high percentage rates of death service charge that the you just don't have the level of service and commitment. I mean, where is the commitment to the telephone and the information technology and the personnel oversight and those kinds of things that they have in a budget of this nature? It's almost zero. So at that particular point, I look at it and say we'd ought to request from Director Weeks some kind of a concession relative to these small budgets.
Let's write that down for
absolutely.
Monday.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? I don't know technically if we can. I think both of you have to be here on the Senate side in order for us to really open a hearing. But
without rules.
Yeah, without rules,
we
flow with that direction.
You can say that they all that you have to have is one smiling face, and that would always improve.
We might need a committee on legislative procedures so we have a better understanding of where we are headed. As we wander adrift in here, I will just leave this subcommittee of the whole committee open. Did you have anything to add, either one of you?
Must have heard you.
Speak of the devil. I will close the subcommittee of the subcommittee and open the open the Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government for a hearing on the Commission on Court Procedures. Or public safety, excuse me. You got me all confused,
Butler. Right room, wrong time.
Right room, wrong time. Representative Butler and I get to spend a lot of time together in this room.
He spends more time with me than he spends with his wife. And that's really irritating.
So, at this point in time, did either of the two of you had anything to close?
I have nothing further in closing other than to say, while our work may look relatively unimportant to the casual observer, it carries huge implications to the citizens of the state of Oregon. Anyone involved in civil litigation, whether it's a small individual or a large corporation, is affected by these rules, and the implementation of these rules can result in costly time delay and expense for litigants. And as I echo the comments of Maury Holland, and that is the council in recent years has given great concern to efficiencies when looking at these rules. The other thing that I'd mention, which is important at least for the citizens of the state of Oregon, is there have been moves to make the citizens who participate as jurors more involved in the court process. I'm not going to go through all those rules, but Judge Dan Harris has taken Oregon to the forefront with rule changes involving things like letting jurors ask questions during the trial, subject to the trial judge's approval, providing written jury instructions, that sort of thing. So, as I said, I could go through all the jury innovation that we've done, but there's more than good value for the money that's being spent here if you take into account not only the volunteerism of the council's members, but also the substantive effect that it has when you have caring people looking after these rules.
Well, please pass along my best to the commission and thank them for their volunteer work while you have some innovations. And since Judge Harris is in my county, while I may not agree with all of his practices in terms of his jury involvement as a former prosecutor in Jackson County, I just want to pass along my thanks to the rest of the members of the commission.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Other members of the public who might wish to testify in regard to the commission? There was one person on the list, but I assume that they have not. Satish?
Yes,
Just for the record.
Sitting in for Adam Ferguson. This agency is not under executive budgetary control, so we do not have any recommendations.
Thank you. Anything further?
Is he a lawyer? Is that good?
He could
what
be.
What an easy job.
He could be. Yeah. He could be.
Very succinct.
All right. Anything else for... All right. I'll close the public hearing. Then anything else for the good of the committee? All right. See you all here. Same time, same place. We're adjourned.